Thank you, Robert. And hi, everybody. My name's Don Major, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Don.
And I'm just really grateful to be here with you guys this weekend. I got to say that I've never been treated nicer anywhere. Liz has been so sweet to me all along on calling me and arranging for me to be here. And I woke up with an abscess tooth this morning. She even found me a dentist and got me some antibiotics. So Liz knows how to take care of the speakers. And Robert's just been a real sweetheart. Drove all the way up to pick me up at Jackson at the airport. And we're going to get the car racing again tonight, apparently. So that... be fine. And the basket, I don't know whether the person who actually put it together is here tonight or not, but that basket was absolutely the most thoughtful basket that I've ever gotten anywhere as a speaker. It was just great. So thank you. I can tell you folks have got some great AA down here in the Delta, so thank you for letting me be a part of it. And what I need to do up here for a few minutes, if I'll let God get me out of the way, and it's real important to me that I say it that way, that I let God get me out of the way, because the first few years I was going around giving talks, I'd say, if I can get myself out of the way, this is what we're going to do. And folks, if I could get me out of the way, I wouldn't even need to be up here. Getting me out of the way has always been the problem, and it's always been too big a job for me, and it's still too big a job for me. So I've got to depend on God to get me out of the way. And if I do that, I'd like to talk a little bit about what I was like and what happened and what I'm like now. And, you know, the last few months it's been really important to me that the book says something else about our stories that I'd overlooked for a long time. The book says that our stories tell in our own language and from our own point of view how we've been able to form a relationship with our God. And that's real, real important to me that my story tell that, because that's at the heart of all of it. You see, I used every human power that I could find to try to do something about my drinking problem. And it wasn't a matter that those human powers weren't quite enough to do the trick. Those human powers didn't seem to have any impact at all. Didn't do any good at all. It wasn't until I was able, through you guys and these 12 steps, to form a relationship with a loving God that I didn't even know was there for me, that I was able to get any relief at all from what was absolutely killing me. So it's real important to me that it carries some of that. And, you know, last night when John was talking, and I've just really enjoyed everybody so far, and the race car started up, it reminded me of a story that I'm going to tell. I guess it was 12 or 14 years ago, I was talking at a meeting there in Louisville, where I'm from, and it was a meeting that met in a middle school. And it was summertime, and they were doing some construction on the middle school, so we had to have the meeting outside. So I'm out there. It's hard to get people to hear you when you're talking outside anyway. So I get out there and start to talk, and this fella next door decides to mow his yard. So all during my talk, this fella's coming by there with that lawnmower, and I'm thinking, now, this is the most negative thing. Nothing on earth can come out of this except just bad. This is terrible. So I assumed that it had been a bad talk and a bad deal and forgot about it for about 3 years. And about 3 years later, a guy came up to me at a meeting there in Louisville and said, by the way, you remember talking over at Highland Middle School about 3 years ago and some fellow next door was mowing the yard? I said, yeah, as a matter of fact, I do. He said, well, I'm that fellow. And I heard enough as I would come by and after I'd shut the mower off, that I decided maybe I better try this AA thing, and I've been sober 3 years. So you never know. You never know what's going on. My body grew up on a tobacco farm in southwestern Kentucky, and the rest of me is still tagging along, you know, growing up and growing old at the same time. And before I got sober, I really and truly had the most interesting romantic story about how by my iron will and my sterling intellect, I'd pull myself up by the bootstraps from the depths of poverty to those staggering heights I'd reach. And I was so sincere about that I would usually have you and me both crying before I was halfway done with that tale. And I hadn't been sober 30 days before I figured out that was all a bunch of crap. We weren't even poor. By the grace of God, I got sober April the 9th, 1981, and I was 37 years old when I got sober. And for that first 37 years, I was convinced that I had grown up in poverty, and we weren't even close to poor. We were middle-class farming people that had everything we needed and a lot of the things that we wanted. And also those staggering heights, man, they were a whole lot more staggering than they were high. I've had to watch all my life being a legend in my own mind. See, my alcoholism is a disease of superlatives. I have trouble thinking in terms of even good and bad, much less ordinary. I think in terms of best and worst. You know, the first thing I want to be is usually the best. But if I can't be the best, the next thing I want to be is usually not second best. The next thing I want to be is the worst. I just want to stay as far from ordinary as I possibly can. And the truth is that I have always been both drunk and sober. A whole lot more ordinary garden variety than my ego has ever been able to stand. When I look back on my childhood now, I look at it kind of in light of something that my original sponsor, who was Cherry Carpenter from Nashville, Tennessee. Cherry died about 10 years ago. And something Cherry told me the first week I was sober. He said, "Don, you know, this thing called alcoholism that you've got is a whole bunch of things." He said, "It's incurable, progressive, and fatal." He said, "It's a physical allergy to alcohol, which means that once you start to drink, you nor anybody else can predict your behavior." He said, "That physical allergy also means that at some point, if you're an alcoholic, the phenomenon of craving will kick in, and then that thing will progress. And once that phenomenon of craving kicks in, then your body starts craving that drink when you get some in your body." He said, "The bottom line on the physical allergy to alcohol is you start drinking, you're going to die." He said, "That's coupled with mental obsession. And the big book tells us that that mental obsession is stronger than the physical allergy." And I don't know about you guys, but the last time I checked on my physical allergy, it was pretty doggone strong. And he said, "What that mental obsession does, it assures that even though we have laid somewhere in an asylum or a gutter or wherever, and we have shook it out, and we have lived through one more time getting it out of our system, and we have sworn, we have said, 'Oh yeah, I see these people are right, man, I get this stuff in my body, and I can't stop. These people are right. I'm powerless over it. So I'll have better sense and start this insanity over again. I won't pick it up again and start it over.'" He said, "The mental obsession absolutely ensures that if I don't do something about what's wrong inside me, I'm going to pick up that first drink. That ultimately I'm as powerless over drink two or over drink one as I am over drink two or drink 22. He told me that this alcoholism has made me real sick emotionally, mentally, physically, spiritually. But he went on to say that it had not started out as any of those things. He said, "Don, the first thing wrong with you is that you've got a disorder of your ego. And on account of that disorder of your ego, all your life you've been so obsessed with yourself, so obsessed with how you feel, so obsessed with how you believe you stack up against other people, that all your life that obsession with yourself has created so much pain and so much emptiness down inside you that you have never been able to stand the way you felt inside without either running as hard as you could or stuffing something in there to try to do something about that pain and that emptiness." And he pointed out, which I never could see the connection for a long, long time, but that really is all the book is saying when it says selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. If selfishness and self-centeredness are the root of my troubles, the first thing wrong with me is I've got an ego disorder. And everything else has flowed from that. And when I look back on my childhood in that light, that's all that was really going on, because I never felt like I was in the right place at the right time with the right stuff. All my life I've been an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. And what I mean by that is I've always been perfectly capable of feeling too good for something and not nearly good enough for the same thing at the same time. Too smart for something and too dumb for the same thing at the same time. Now, add to that, for whatever reason, I truly have always been very, very ambitious and terribly lazy at the same time. Now, you get all that conflict going on inside of a kid, and you've got a mess going on. And every time one of those spontaneous flyover gut checks would happen, you know, I wouldn't be intending to say, "Hey, Don, how you doing down there?" But, you know, you just turn around, and there you are. And though that would happen, and the question would get asked, "Hey, how you doing down there?" And from down inside me would come, "Hey, boy, don't be looking down here and don't be asking that stuff, because you can't stand seeing what's here and what's missing down here. You keep moving. do that cute and smart deal of yours. And if you can't get that to fly, then just create a negative disturbance. But do whatever's necessary to keep anybody else from drawing a bead on you and seeing what's there and what's missing. Because a part of me knew that if you saw, I might have to look at it, and I couldn't stand that. And that's pretty well the way I made it through the first 12 or 13 years of my life, generally staying a half step ahead of a screaming fit. Now, the screaming fit would catch me with some regularity, but I was ahead of it most of the time. Another couple of things about what I was like is that I believe on account of my ego disorder that until I was 37 and got sober, that I was never able to give any consideration to the possibility that there might be a power greater than myself that had anything to do with running my life on a daily basis. I didn't have a problem with some sort of intellectual theory about a creative intelligence or whatever. But my ego just wouldn't admit the possibility that there was some power greater than my little old brain as far as running every minute of every hour of every day for me. And I believe on account of that same ego, and I think that's what my religious friends today call the idea of a personal God, that was just absolutely unacceptable to my ego. And on account of that same disorder, I don't think I had any teachability or humility whatsoever until I got sober at 37. And the reason I don't is I've never been able to remember a single time in that first 37 years that I ever voluntarily followed a suggestion that anybody made about how to run my life unless I understood it, I agreed with it, and I thought it would work. And, you know, that still doesn't sound bad. I mean, I'm a fairly intelligent guy. Why in the world should I do anything about my life if I don't understand it or I don't agree with it or I don't think it'll work? When I get honest about it, it's pretty simple. See, my alcoholism has got a lot of different parts to it. And one part of my alcoholism has been running its mouth ever since I can remember. And it hadn't slowed down. And that old crazy picture show that rolls in the back of my head, got news for you folks, it hadn't quit running. And I am so grateful that Cherry Carpenter, my sponsor, told me in real early sobriety, he said, "Don, don't get it in your head that recovery means that your illness is not going to keep talking to you or that that crazy picture show is not going to keep rolling." He said, "If you get it in your head that that's recovery, you'll get frustrated and think you don't have recovery and you might give up." He said, "Recovery isn't those things going away. Recovery is you being able to realize that they are not reality and you don't have to obey them. Recovery is getting to the point where most of the time you can recognize them for what they are and go on and do the next right thing even though they're telling you to do something else." And see, this illness that talks to me, I don't think it's ever tried to kill me. And the reason I don't think it's ever tried to kill me is I don't think it cares whether I live or die. And I don't think my illness cares whether you live or die. I don't think my illness has got but one reason for existing, and that's try to get itself a drink. And it'll do anything in this universe to try to increase its chances of getting that drink. It'll tell me something that'll kill me or will kill you. It'll tell me totally inconsistent lies back to back with one another without dropping a stitch. It just throws it all up against the wall hoping something will stick. And that would be fine if all the time I could sit there and just say, "Oh, yeah, that's just my insanity and my illness talking to me. I'll just chuckle at that and do the next right thing." But you see, I got another problem. If my alcoholism is anything, it's a disease of perception. And what that means is real simple. That means I don't see things right. I don't hear them right. I don't recognize them for what they are. And the bottom line, I'll wind up believing those deadly lies if I'm not going to do it unless I understand it, I agree with it, and I think it'll work. So when I'm doing it that way, what I've done is I've put the ultimate veto power in the universe in my brain. And with what I've got wrong with me, when I do that, I'm under death sentence. And I believe with all my heart today, just as I begin to put that veto power back in my brain, that I move back toward that death sentence. And you know what's so scary about that? That has never one time felt like the ultimate veto power in the universe. You know what it always feels like? Common sense. And that's exactly the way my insane ideas, all of them, come up to me. I've never one time had an insane idea walk up and say, "Good morning, Don. I'm a crazy idea, and I'm here to try to kill you today, partner." Because, see, I probably wouldn't mess with that thing if it came up and announced itself that way. So my insane ideas always come up the same way. They say, "Good morning, Don. How you doing, buddy? I'm Common Sense." And they immediately start talking about how special I am. they immediately start talking about how unique the pressures on me are, and if you guys had all those pressures on you, why, you'd do it that way too. And then he'll tell me that a lot of you are doing it and just won't cop out to it, you know. And then he'll really get the hook. He'll say, well, look here, Don, this is not even really selfish. You know, three or four times removed down here, it's a possibility it might help somebody. So you know you've got to do this. It's just common sense. And, folks, that's why I've got to be here tonight. That's why I've got to come in these rooms, and I've got to have the fellowship. That's why I can't lock myself up in a room with my higher power and a big book and meditate and levitate and stay sober and half sane. Because, you see, in the time I've been sober, not one single time has one of my insane ideas sounded like common sense to any one of you guys. I don't care if you haven't been out of the asylum 48 hours, you knock it out for me just like that. And I can do the same thing for you. And that's the magic of the fellowship for me. One more quick thing about what I was like. It was always my ambition to be an alcoholic. That's what I wanted to grow up to be. But, of course, I didn't know that until I'd been sober about a year. But when I look back on it, by the time I was 4 or 5, I looked around at the decent, responsible, hard-working men in the farming community where I grew up, and here's what I saw. I saw a bunch of really dull-looking old guys in overalls out there driving beat-up, paid-for pickup trucks. And these guys would be married to ladies that, even though I was a little boy, they didn't look very interesting to me, you know. A lot of times they'd be wearing these old flour sack dresses, and they looked real drab. And more often than not, they'd have a whole house full of those snotty-nosed kids. And these guys would get up every morning of their life, go get in that, eat breakfast with that drab-looking woman and all those kids, and go get in that old beat-up, paid-for pickup truck, and go right exactly where somebody had told them to go. And all day they would do what somebody had told them to do. And what really blew me away is that at supper time, they would come back to the same people they'd left that morning and eat supper and go to bed with the chickens and get up the next day and do the same fool thing. And then maybe on Sunday you'd see them load the whole crew in the pickup and go up the road to Julian Baptist Church or down the road to Locust Grove Baptist Church. Then on Sunday afternoon they might do something like go visit people, for goodness sakes. Well, see, part of my ego disorder is to this day I have never been able to look at anything or anybody with but one knee-jerk reaction. Now, thank God I don't have to act on it today. But the only knee-jerk reaction I've ever been able to have to anything or anybody is, of course, what has this got to do with me? So I looked at those guys and made those observations and had the only reaction I could have. And it came to me, well, you're a little boy and they're grown men, so maybe when you grow up, that's what your life will be like. And it like to have scared me to death. It absolutely terrified me to think that I might grow up to have anything in common with those decent, responsible men. Now, by the time I was about 7 years old, my older brother Dan, who's 13 years older than I had finally aggravated him to the point that he would occasionally take me over in the wet county where they had the beer joints. And let me say this. There's already been some talk about the dysfunctional situations. First, I believe very strongly in page 133 of the Big Book. I believe that God filled this world with wonderful doctors and wonderful counselors, and we should not hesitate to use them if they are needed. I also believe that if we take our alcoholism to those people instead of using this fellowship and these steps on it, it's a whole lot like taking a jellyfish to an orthopedic surgeon. There's just nothing in us those good people can work on. And I believe if we're trying to do that instead of working the steps, we're standing on a whale's back fishing for minnows. So that being said, I'm not knocking doctors, I'm not knocking counselors, I'm not knocking treatment. I'm all for all that. But I don't have any idea in the world what a dysfunctional family is. Now, Jeff may have changed this whole part of my talk this morning because he claims his family was functional. And I haven't talked to Jeff about that in depth, but if he did come up from a functional family, he'll be the first person I've ever met who claimed that they came from a functional family. So until I can identify what a functional family is, I don't have any idea how I'll identify what a dysfunctional family is. But what I am pretty sure of is that my family did not cause my alcoholism and that I was the most dysfunctional thing in it. But at any rate, by the time I was about to say I might have aggravated Dan until he would take me over, and what he would do, Dan would drink beer, and he'd let me drink big oranges and eat pickled eggs, and of course I would observe and listen while I was doing that. And first thing I noticed was those honky-tonk heroes had those big flashy cars out there that they couldn't afford. And then we'd walk on in, and Lord, could those guys sit at a bar cool. I honestly have got a picture burned in my mind right tonight of how they looked. It impressed me so much. Lord, they'd do stuff like sit there at that bar and gaze down into the depths of a beer. I'm talking about lost in it. And it looked like to me they'd gaze into it for an hour without batting an eyelash. And then maybe they'd turn around the glass around real slow and tap on it with a ring while they were doing it. And I could look at those guys and tell they were intelligent and deep and romantic. And, Lord, they were so much more interesting than those old drones out there on the farm. And then I'd look over in the booth and I'd see one of them with his arm draped around a lady that looked a lot more interesting to me than those old gals out there in those flour sack dresses. And those fellas didn't care if they were married to somebody else, and they didn't care if those women were married to somebody else. But the most magic thing of all, I didn't get to finish the first big orange before I had overheard enough conversations in those bars to find out that almost every one of those guys was only about that far from being rich and famous. They all had a great big deal that was just about to pop, and they were flat going to be somebody. Now, it was usually a good big deal, but not always. The important word was big. If they had a bad deal, it was a big bad deal. You know, if one of them had some trouble with the law, he didn't have a little trouble with the law. He was going to the pen for longer than any SOB ever did, by God. Well, I took one look at it. And what I was taking a look at, of course, was self-will run riot, total disregard for other people, total disregard for honesty. And I fell in love with everything about it. From the first time I got a good look at those guys with their insanity, with their disregard for other people, with their big deals, I never really had but one ambition. I wanted to grow up to be just exactly like them. And I got my ambition. I just didn't know what the right name for it was. I got drunk the first time when I was either 12 or 13 years old. And at first night, I got in an awful lot of trouble, and I puked, blacked out, passed out, woke up the next morning, had a terrible hangover, and I swore all those Baptists were right, and I'd never do that again. And, of course, it was less than a week before I got drunk the second time because the magic had happened. Now, I didn't know the magic had happened. All I knew was that for a few minutes on my way to puking and getting in all that trouble and so on, I passed through a real pleasant neighborhood is all I knew had happened. But looking back on it, I know now the magic had happened. When I got enough of that stuff in me that for the first time it did something about that pain and that emptiness that obsession with myself had created all my life, what happened was that for the next 25 years, since that was the only place that I knew that I could get that relief, when the pain got bad enough, and it's been my absolute experience that alcoholism will make sure that the pain gets bad enough if it thinks it can get itself a drink. It will make sure of it. And when the pain would get bad enough, it didn't matter what it cost. Because, you see, I've already told you that the most important thing in the universe to me is how I feel. And if I felt bad enough, it didn't matter who it cost or what it cost. I had to try it one more time and give up whatever I had to give up to chase that relief one more time. And as far as I'm concerned, that's at the very heart of my powerlessness over alcohol. And that next 25 years, I'm not going to spend much time on tonight, but from the time of that first drunk until I got sober was just about 25 years. And during that 25 years, not only alcoholism, but alcohol absolutely dominated my life. I'm very confident that I went to bed drunk at least 80% of the nights in that 25 years. Nothing happened in my life that didn't happen around alcohol. I believe that I threw up when I brushed my teeth approximately half the time for those 25 years. And did not know, by the way, until I got sober that was abnormal. I'd started doing it when I was 12 or 13, so to the extent that I thought about it, I sort of associated it with reaching puberty. You know, I'd never talked to many people about it because you don't talk about puking at cocktail parties. You know, you said, "Did you puke when you brushed your teeth this morning?" So, you know, I just didn't know. So alcohol dominated everything. By the time I was 16, I'd gotten in enough trouble with the drinking that I thought I had to get away from the farm because of my reputation from the drinking and some problems that I'd caused. So I left school and took a Greyhound bus 200 miles up to Louisville, and school had always been really easy for me, and I wound up on the doorstep of the University of Louisville and became an early admission student, and over the next 8 years, I drank and worked my way through undergraduate and law school, and I've got very few memories of that 8 years. It's just a blur. In the spring of 1968, I graduated from law school, and my daughter, who was my only child for over 20 years, was born. Started practicing law in downtown Louisville in 1968, and for the next 10 years practiced with a pretty good little bit of material success. For the first several years that I was giving AA talks around, I had been fabulously successful during that 10 years, and if I stay sober 30 and live 30 years, I may have been a total failure. I don't know, but the best I can do right now at 18 years is I was moderately successful, folks. And during that 10 years, while I could still hold on to material things by my fingernails and rub that in your face if you suggested there was something wrong with a fellow who didn't sleep in beds about a third of the nights, didn't make any attempt to sleep in beds, if you suggested there was something wrong with a fellow that couldn't have any relationship with any human being with any reality to it, honesty was totally out of the question, but I couldn't even have one with reality. If you suggested there was something wrong with a fellow that couldn't put gas in cars, for years I ran out of gas two or three times a month in Louisville in brand new expensive cars with a pocket full of money and a pocket full of credit cards. Just simply was too sick to put gas in cars. Couldn't take care of my teeth. Probably why I had an abscess tooth today, Liz. But if you suggested there was something wrong with me, that's what I would rub in your face, was the fact that I was holding it together with spit and baling wire on a material plane. During that 10 years, I began to use a lot of things other than alcohol, but during that 10 years, they were just sad shows to the booze, like they were with Bill and Dr. Bob. They were things to increase the effect of the booze, to decrease the effect of the booze, to change the effect of the booze, to help me try to function on a hangover. But the booze remained the big tent during that 10 years. February 10th, 1978 was a Friday, and it started out like most of my days did, with a terrible hangover and being propelled out of the bed by terror. See, I didn't have any ambition. What motivated me was terror. Terror that if I didn't get out of that bed and go stick that toothbrush in my mouth and puke and put on the clothes that I thought I was supposed to and show up where I thought I was supposed to and make the noise I thought I was supposed to, that you'd see what I was and I'd have to face what I was. I didn't have ambition. That's what motivated me, was that terror. So that same terror propelled me out of the bed that morning, and I wound up the office and going to court, and by noon I was at a restaurant and bar there in Louisville, and I spent the afternoon drinking scotch and snorting cocaine. And I decided sometime during the afternoon that I needed to get out of town for a long weekend because I'd been working so hard. And now by that time, I was remarried to my daughter's mama. And I'm not going to get into that, but you know, nobody does that but us. And we do it all the time. We don't think there's anything wrong with, you know, old Joe and Sue are divorced, but they date and they probably get back together. I got to tell you something. A person who is not an alcoholic, a dope fiend, or so Al-Anon sick that they can't crawl, if they think about remarrying somebody they've divorced, they'll go stick their head in an oven or something. But we just do it all the time. So I was remarried to my daughter's mama, but it was not she that I called to go with me on my trip that weekend. I got hold of a lady that I'd been seeing some of, and I went and picked her up and stopped and got the two bottles of vodka that I thought you had to have for a road trip in 1978. And went and picked her up, took a handful of Quaaludes, and had reservations up north in Indiana, so I headed to southwest Kentucky to see my daddy. And until I get to the wreck, there is absolutely nothing unusual about February 10th of 1978. It was just another day in my life, and that's the truth. I had a new Corvette with a built-in CB back in 78. For you young folks, they built CBs into cars. And I got playing with the CB, and I got hold of a truck driver, and he had some of those little old yellow Dizoxin speed beans, and he wanted some vodka. So we pulled over, and I gave him one of my bottles of vodka, and he gave me a handful of speed, and I made another 50 or 60 miles and went off the road at about 130. And I did an awful lot of bad things to my body, broke both legs, crushed both knees, lost the main artery in one lower leg, and had to do a bypass in my upper leg and take out a vein grafted in to replace the artery, and separated my pelvis and severed my plumbing so that I didn't have a urinary function for over a year. I had a suprapubic catheter, which is simply a plastic tube with a flange on it where they bore a hole in your abdomen, pop that sucker in there to your bladder to carry your urine out to a bag. And I was in the hospital for about 6 months out of the first year, and I had a half dozen major surgeries. The doctors told me early on, it was 2.5 months before they stood me upright on a tilt table for the first time. And the doctors told me early on that I would probably never walk again without at least braces on both legs and one or two canes, and that they doubted that we could find a surgeon anywhere that would attempt to put my plumbing back together so I would ever have a urinary function. Well, purely by the grace of God, and just for the record, I've been sober a little over 18 years, and I haven't owned a brace or a cane for over 19 years. And about a year after the wreck, the head of urology down at Duke University did put my plumbing back together. But I didn't know that was going to happen, and my reaction to that is that to that prognosis is that I would lay in my hospital bed and have my friends bring me in booze and more dope than my doctors were giving me. And I would lay there with a drink in my hand and say things like, you know, fellas, anybody can quit drinking when the going gets a little tough. Takes man laying there with it when the bills start coming in. And then I talked to him about the fact that a man wasn't supposed to be out there doing the crime if he wasn't prepared to do the time, and they weren't going to hear me whining and give me another drink. And, folks, that's true insanity. And it's true powerlessness. I was right where I was after that first drunk. Simply didn't matter what it cost. I didn't go broke right away because a little law firm had built up around this other guy and myself. So some money kept coming in for a while, and my daughter's mama wasn't tickled with the circumstances of the wreck, and so we wound up divorced during that year, and I wound up married to the lady that was with me. And about a year after that wreck, the phenomenon of craving had progressed in me to the point where once I started drinking, I had just pretty well physically lost the ability to stop myself from drinking. Something had to intervene to get me prized loose from alcohol. And when something did get me prized loose from alcohol, it took 3 or 4 days for me to be physically able to really sit up in a chair. And I say a lot of times, and mean it, that those of you who were progressed that far with the physical addiction to ethyl alcohol the last time you checked on it don't need a description of those 3 or 4 days. And those of you who weren't progressed that far the last time you checked on it, not a bit of sense in me wasting my breath, because I'm not going to be able to describe it to you. It's the most powerful physical drive I have ever felt in my life. But at any rate, about a year after that wreck, sometime around the first year of 1979, they took me to my first asylum. And I don't use that word to be funny or cute. Bill Wilson uses that word in a big book. My mama used that word. When I was a kid, it seemed like folks didn't have breakdowns and go to the hospital. They went crazy and got put in the asylum. And that's a whole lot more descriptive of what kept happening to me. I kept going crazy and getting put in the asylum. Well, they put me in the first one and got me through the 3 or 4 days, so I was able to sit up in a chair. And I still had my tube in my belly and my catheter bag, my braces, my crutches. And they got me able to sit up in a chair and, for some strange reason, had an AA meeting. And somebody got up and read how it works. And they got to step three. We had made a decision to turn our will and lives over to the care of God as we understood him. And that insulted my intellect, that those religious fanatics would talk about such claptrap in front of such an intellectual giant. So I just climbed up on my crutches and straightened up my catheter bag and said as loud as I could, "Do you mean to tell me there are people in this world who believe such crap?" And I hobbled on over to call somebody to get me away from those religious fanatics before they somehow polluted my pristine intellect. Now, that was somewhere around the first of the year of 1979. I wound up getting sober about 2.5 years later in April of 81, and I really don't remember much of that 2.5 years, but some of the things that I do know happened are that I went back to the asylum 17 more times. I became addicted to hard narcotics. I became a needle street junkie, and I'm so grateful for that because, you see, that brought enough pressure on my law partners to cause them to kick me out of the law firm that I'd founded, and I proved that I wasn't going to hit bottom. And, you know, for a lot of years sober, hitting bottom was kind of a mystery to me, because I'd look at guys I sponsored that got sober with a great big house and a going business and a family still together, and they'd get sober and just do great. And then other poor guys would be back in the penitentiary for the fourth time, all alcohol and drug related, and it wouldn't even look like they were slowing down, you know, people dying around them on account of the illness. And it really puzzled me what hitting bottom was, but it doesn't puzzle me anymore. To me, hitting bottom is real simple. It's a decision, and it's so important to me. I got this as a pure gift from a guy named Scott from Nashville, Tennessee, that some of you may have heard. It's a decision, and a decision is different from an intention because it doesn't become a decision until I act on it. I may call it a decision, but if I'm not acting on it, it's just an intention. And to me, what bottom is simply that decision that I will do anything without qualification to keep from feeling the way I've been feeling and living the way I've been living. And when I've made that decision, willing to act on it, then I've hit bottom, regardless of what it took to get me there, and regardless of what's going on out here. If I haven't made that decision, willing to act on it, I haven't hit bottom. And I wasn't going to do that as long as I had a Timex watch. I sure wasn't going to do it as long as I had a law firm. The state of Kentucky helped me out a little further by jerking my law license, and my new wife had to leave me on account of my insanity during that period, and she was staying with some girlfriends and died in an accident during that time period. And I last laid eyes on my daughter, my only child, in January of 1980. Didn't see her again for over 3 years. The Internal Revenue took my interest in the office building that we built in downtown Louisville and a couple of things like that. And somebody was talking about the houses on Brownsboro Road. There's a road there in Louisville called Brownsboro Road, and that seemed to be where my ex-wives congregated. In fact, one fellow told me that at the end of my drinking, he said, "Don, next time you want to get married, why don't you not get married and let's just find a woman you don't like and let you buy our house on Brownsboro Road, because that's the way this deal's coming out anyway." But at any rate, the mortgage companies took the houses, and it was just all gone. And after all the material things were gone, my dad was down on the farm in his late 80s with nothing in this world but his Social Security, and I went down and stole that to keep on drinking on. And I've got a much older, badly crippled sister, and I ended up... by using and abusing her to keep on with my drinking. I burned up everybody and everything. And for almost a year and a half, up until the fall of 1980, I lived on the street without an address. And every day of that, I lived with the conscious conviction that I had to die of alcoholism and drug addiction. And the way that happened isn't a mystery to me at all now, because you see, a good half of those places I'm calling asylums had treatment programs that were based on the 12 steps. And since I didn't have anywhere to go, sometimes between trips to the asylum, I would go to an awful lot of meetings. So I had a head full of Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, it's one of my frequent and sincere prayers that I never, ever know as much about AA as I did before I could get sober. And what would happen during that year and a half is that one of you folks would tell me how AA had saved your life and changed your life, and my brain would go, "Yeah, I know it works for you guys, and I'm glad it does, but y'all don't understand how complex I am. And you don't understand how intelligent I am. Y'all don't know that, of course, I've got alcoholism and drug addiction, too, for that matter. But you don't understand that those are just little results of this magnificent, terrible complexity that's Don Major. You know, I can't, in a simple-minded fashion like you guys apparently can, address these little symptoms over here and expect this terrible complexity to go away. And y'all didn't understand that I had just played on so much broader stage than you guys had. And, Lord, I saw things so much more clearer, and I felt them so much more acutely. I was wounded by my own understanding, and my soul was too big for my body. So it couldn't work for me because I was so magnificent." Now, the very next heartbeat, one of you guys would tell me how AA had saved your life and changed your life. And my brain would go, "Yeah, I know it works for you guys. But y'all don't know about the parts of me that have always been missing. Y'all don't know that I've never been able to love anybody, not really, not even myself. And you don't know that I've never been able to be consistently responsible about one single thing in my entire life. And you don't know that anything in my life that looks like it was good or even okay is some kind of pack of lies and a house of cards. And you guys have got things left to get sober with, and y'all have got things left to get sober for. Y'all don't know how bad I've been. Y'all don't know that I have destroyed everything and salted the earth behind me. There's nothing left. There's nothing for me to get sober on, and God knows there's no reason for me to get nothing for me to get sober for. So it won't work for me because I'm so terrible." Very next heartbeat, it'd be back telling me it wouldn't work for me because I'm so magnificent, and I'm believing it both times, just going right on. So for that reason, for that year and a half, I've drifted into oblivion with that knowledge that I had to die of alcoholism sitting on my chest, and it was sitting right on my chest when I came to. The fall of 1980,
I washed up on the doorstep of an asylum in Nashville, Tennessee, and they let me in because they didn't think I'd live another week if they left me on the street. And I stayed in there a while, and came time to get out. Of course, I had no home. I had no car. My teeth were falling out of my head. I assumed I was under indictment in Louisville, and I to this day believe that was a reasonable assumption. I knew there were some former clients with very good reason to kill me, with very good capabilities of killing me. So there was a big question of what to do with me. And my roommate's family there in Nashville felt sorry for me, and they said, "Don, why don't you come stay with us a few days while we try to figure out what to do with you?" And I went and lived with them for over a year on charity. And for the first 6 months, I didn't stay straight, but I got better. And I believe in my case, I needed to get better before I could truly begin to recover. During that 6 months, I went to an awful lot of AA meetings, most of them at a clubhouse there in Nashville called the 202 Club. And I got to where sometimes I could go as long as 2 or 3 weeks without getting messed up, and that was a world record for me. In or out of an asylum, I had never been that long without getting messed up since I'd gotten drunk that first time at 12 or 13. And I guess how I really know I got better is that in that whole six-month period, they only put me back in a rubber room one time. And at the rate I'd been going, I would have been delighted to settle for twice a year in the asylum. In fact, I thought it was the picture of mental health. But in early March of 81, I finally got up enough nerve to send a letter back into Louisville with a return address to get a check from an insurance company on account of my wife's death, and it took me a year to get up enough nerve to send that letter, even though I was living on the street destitute. And you know what? I still don't think there was any paranoia in that. I think my fear of letting people in Louisville know where I was extremely well grounded. I think a loving God's gone back and poured oil on the troubled waters of my past to keep the worst of what I feared from happening. But in early March of 81, I got up enough nerve. I sent the letter. They sent the check. And I got there in late March, and I got drunk. And by the time April the 8th of 81 rolled around, which was the last day I drank, I'd been drunk 10 days or 2 weeks, and it was another one of my pop-off vodka slash Listerine drunks. And believe me, I've drunk a barrel of both of them. And to be rigorously honest with you, I have better memories of the Listerine than I do that old hot pop-off. Now, it cost a little more than the pop-off. You just average it ounce to ounce, but it tastes just as good, and it would get me just as drunk. Now, my medical friends tell me that drinking the Listerine is like playing Russian roulette, so I'm not suggesting that any of you go try it. It just happens that I slid through on living. You know, that's something that I may not say as much as I should, because I've had people come up to me after my talk and mention this. This convention, the theme of it is the age of miracles is still with us. I want to tell you something, folks. The fact that I'm alive is a miracle. Any of you folks out there that are new or are playing with going out there and trying again, please don't think that there's a very good chance that you can go out there and get as bad as I did and then come on in and get straight. Because the fact is that most folks that get that bad don't get straight. That it's a pure miracle and the grace of God that I'm alive, and that most people don't survive what I went through. So don't get to thinking you can live, drink Listerine and live, and you keep on going and get to where I was and then get sober, because you just may not get there. Something that I was told in early sobriety that's helped me an awful lot. You know, we think about the Skid Row bum as the picture of an alcoholic, and only about 2% of the alcoholics ever make it to Skid Row. You know why? Don't live long enough. That's why we don't make it to Skid Row. Alcohol kills us before we ever make it to Skid Row. But at any rate, I kind of got off on a rabbit track there, but that felt important to say, so I did. So I'm sitting on the edge of this bed in a motel in Nashville on April 8th of 1981, and a loving God started giving me a whole lot of gifts. Now, for the first few weeks I was sober, I didn't have any idea that there was any such thing as a loving God or that anything was giving me any gifts. But looking back on it, I know now that the biggest gift that I'd gotten was the first tiny little bit of teachability or humility I'd ever had in my life. The first willingness to do some things that were suggested, even though I didn't understand them, I didn't agree with them, I didn't think they would work, and I sure didn't want to do them. And folks, coming off that most recent drunk of mine in April of 81, did not feel a bit different than the 199 before it. Now, John talks about the moment of clarity, and I'm sure I've had one in there somewhere. But if I had kept waiting for it to feel different, for me to start acting different, I know for an absolute fact that I would have been rotting in a grave for 18 years. If I had kept waiting to see that burning bush, if I'd kept waiting for my mind to change, if I'd kept waiting to believe that Alcoholics Anonymous would work for me, if I'd kept waiting until it felt like Alcoholics Anonymous was working for me to start blandly doing what you folks in this big book told me to do, I would have been rotting in that grave for all those years. That was the biggest gift my God had given me, and I had no idea that I had it. Well, I shook it out for 3 or 4 days so that I was able to stumble, and I stumbled into the 202 clubhouse there in Nashville, and I didn't know whether they would let me in or not. I really didn't, because they knew me very well. They knew me because I had passed out in their AA meetings and had to be bodily carried out of the meetings. They knew me because they had caught me shooting dope in their men's room. And they knew me because they had warned the people they sponsored to stay away from me, that I was a loser and I was going to die. About 2 months before I got sober, I was walking through that clubhouse, and a big old tall boy named Joe W., about 6'6", walked up and looked down at me, and he said, "Don, you know, I'm beginning to think you really are too intelligent for this program." Only knee-jerk reaction I had was, well, thank God they finally figured out who they're dealing with here. But he went on, and he said, "And you know, that's a real shame, because we have never had anybody too dumb for this deal, and we bury you buttholes all time." And something in that stuck, something that grabbed. And it was still stuck in there 2 months later when I stumbled in that door, and I went in with my Siamese twin. And my Siamese twin, for the last 2 or 3 years I drank, was incomprehensible demoralization. And I stumbled in there with my incomprehensible demoralization. I said, "Will you guys tell me one more time what I need to do if I want to live?" And they said, "Sure, Don, we'll be glad to. It's keeping us sober." They said, "Don't drink, don't take dope, and go to meetings." And by the grace of God, that first 60 days, I went to over 150 meetings. Now, I do need to tell you this, that it was very clear to me during that 60 days that I did not need to go to all those meetings. And although I was unemployed and very unemployable, I think John was talking about this last night, most of those meetings, I did not have time to go to those meetings. And it was clear to me much of the time sitting in those meetings that they weren't doing any good, that you guys were religious fanatics and my intellectual inferiors. And I was sitting in those meetings, and my brain was assuring me that what I needed to do was get my head out of the sand, get my butt back to Louisville, get some money, get a law license, get a good-looking woman, a Rolex, a Jaguar, my God, be somebody. But I'd been given this beautiful gift that I didn't know I had, of being able to turn around in my brain and say, "Yeah, I know, it's perfectly clear, isn't it? But you and I have nearly killed one another, partner. And we don't have anything else to do except go keep going to these dumb old meetings that can't possibly help us." So I kept coming to your dumb old meetings, and guess what? They worked just as well as if I had thought they were exactly what I needed. See, I had it all backwards. I thought in order for AA to work, it had to feel like it was working. I had to believe it was working. I thought I even had to be able to see the causal connections between what was causing what and making it work. Turned out that didn't have a thing to do with it. All I needed to do was get my raggedy butt to meeting after meeting after meeting and let my old sick brain and soul finally get dragged in there kicking and screaming behind my raggedy butt. Then they told me if I wanted to live, I was going to have to read the big book. And I said, "But I've read the big book 3 or 4 times." And they said, "Don, we know. You've been quoting it to us while you've been dying, dummy." They said, "If you want to live, you've got to get some things straight that you've got exactly backwards about that book." Said, "You've got it in your head some sort of way that that book's a philosophy book, and that there's some way you can study that book, that there's something in there you can master or absorb that's going to somehow transport you to a sublime state of sobriety." They said, "Partner, it doesn't work that way." Said, "This book is not a philosophy book. There's nothing in here you can learn that'll keep you sober for a heartbeat." And it was then that I finally had ears to hear what I know they'd told me dozens of times. Maybe this was my moment of clarity. I was able to hear them when they said, "Don, you have probably known enough about Alcoholics Anonymous for 2 years to stay sober the rest of your life." They said, "What's killing you, partner, isn't what you know and don't know. What's killing you is what you're doing and not doing." They said, "What this book is a simple instruction manual for your actions." And they said, "While there's nothing in here you can learn that'll keep you sober for a heartbeat, if you'll go through this book land for land, starting at the front cover and reading only the black part and looking for what it says do and do what this book says do, you'll not only be able to stay comfortably sober a day at a time indefinitely, you're going to be rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence. And by the grace of God, that's exactly the way it worked with me. It was about that time that they explained to me that the steps are the only program for recovery. That the fellowship, which is absolutely necessary, which I talked about earlier, I've got to have it because I've got to talk with you people. I've got to have your support. I've got to have your feedback. But I can't go to enough meetings to be in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a member of the fellowship on any day I've got a desire to stop drinking, but the book makes it clear. Here are the steps we took that are suggested as a program of recovery. Nothing else is called a program of recovery, so there's no other program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was so glad when John brought up last night the my program, your program deal. Cherry Carpenter used to just stop me dead cold when I would say my program. He said, Don, your program got you here, partner. And my program got me here. There's not but one program, and it's numbered 1 through 12. And they told me what it means is I'm going to be going to 10 meetings a week. If I find 30 people dumb enough to ask somebody who hadn't done the steps to sponsor them, I'm going to be sponsoring 30 people and be talking at conferences all over the country and working part-time in a treatment center. And if I have not done steps 1 through 9 the way that book says do them in order to reach a state of recovery, or having done that, I'm not living every day of my life on 10, 11, and 12 in order to maintain my spiritual condition and get my daily reprieve and not lose my recovery and fall back in the pit and dab this incurable, progressive, and fatal thing. I'm not even in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I try to do it that way, if I latch onto this fellowship like a leech without doing the steps, I might stay dry for a week or for 30 years. But if I do it that way, I'll have absolutely no healing of what's really wrong. That inability to be comfortable inside myself, that emptiness, that pain, that self-centeredness, except just exactly as I do those steps. And they explained to me that those steps work on alcoholism just exactly like penicillin works on an infection. They said, Don, if you've got an infection that's going to kill you if it's not treated but will respond to penicillin, said, you don't need to understand your infection. Said, you don't even need to be absolutely intellectually convinced that that infection is causing all those terrible things wrong with magnificent you. And it said, you don't need to understand one single thing about how penicillin works in the human body. Said, you don't need to want to take the penicillin. If you have got the infection and you take the penicillin as directed, you're going to get just fine, thank you. And they said, these steps work on alcoholism exactly the same way. So they're not there for you to memorize or not memorize. They're not there for you to agree with or not agree with, for you to learn about or not learn about, to want to do or not want to do. They're there for you to simply do the way this book says do it if you want to live with this thing called alcoholism. And I found out that that's exactly the way the steps work on my alcoholism, is the action does it every time. Then they told me if I wanted to live, I was going to have to get on my knees every morning and ask a power greater than myself to get through the day without drinking and drugging, and get on my knees at night and thank that power, and the tears came to my eyes. I truly started crying because, see, for 2.5 years it had been perfectly obvious to me that if I was going to get this thing, if I was going to live, I had to somehow make myself start thinking, feeling, and believing the way it looked like to me you guys thought, felt, and believed, and I had tried so hard. I had tried every way I knew to adjust my thoughts and my feelings and my beliefs, to change them, and I couldn't change any of them. I couldn't get to first base. So I was explaining this to them by saying that, you know, no, I can't get on my knees because the second step's killing me on account of that. I can't believe that way and that sort of thing, and I finally heard them. When they said, Don, we have never suggested that you think, feel, or believe anything. And my mouth fell open because, see, right at the very heart of this self-centeredness that is my alcoholism is this insane conviction that what I think, feel, and believe is the center of the universe. My Lord, we can't have little Donnie doing something he doesn't feel like doing. Man, in the first place, that would be hypocritical. And, you know, we can chuckle at larceny and adultery that happened when we were drinking. And if enough time's gone by and the circumstances were just right, we can get a small little smile out of just the right homicide. But, my God, we don't want to be hypocrites. That's just the worst thing in the world. And to this day, if I wake up and don't feel like going to work, do you know what every fiber in my body wants to do? Call one of you people and aggravate you about the fact that I don't feel like going to work. And what can we do to make me feel like going to work? Well, folks, what difference does it make whether I feel like going to work? I have to go to work. And over the years, I found out something that's been a terrible shock to me. Absolutely the only therapy that has ever done any good for the problem of me not wanting to go to work has been going to work. Now, I don't get that way naturally, because that's those thoughts, feelings, and beliefs I'm just convinced are the center of everything. So here they're telling me they've never suggested that I think, feel, or believe anything. So I'm standing there with my mouth open. And they said, well, no, Don, said, we wouldn't have done that. Said, in your case, you are far too sick to have any valid thoughts, feelings, or beliefs whatsoever. And they said, in the second place, your thoughts, feelings, and beliefs are your illness. Your illness is your thoughts, feelings, and beliefs, and they are one and the same thing. And they said, in the third place, the issue of whether you live or die is going to be determined solely by what you do. What you think, feel, or believe won't have one thing to do with it. So they said, if you want to live, you better get down on your knees and start saying those words and don't worry about what's going through your head, because it won't count. Well, in April of 1981, I started getting down there morning and night and saying those words, purely acting as if embarrassed. Lord, it was humiliating, a fellow of my intellectual stature, to be down there doing something like that. And I was afraid they'd catch me and put me back in this asylum and keep me for doing that. But I started getting down there in April of 81, every morning and every night, and saying those words. And guess what? The miracle of the second step happened, and I came to believe along the line. My belief's never been perfect. Nobody's belief is perfect. If belief were perfect, it wouldn't be belief. It would be knowledge. You know, one of my favorite prayers is, Lord, I believe. Please forgive my disbelief. The only belief or faith that has any value whatsoever to me is my willingness to act out belief and faith. That nice warm feeling that I had confused with faith all my life, that nice feeling that God's got me in the palm of his or her hand and I know everything is just absolutely going to be all right, I thought that was faith. That's not faith. That's the reward for faith. Faith is doing that next right thing that I know in my heart, because that little spark of the divine will always tell me where to take the next stitch. It's not ever going to clue me in on the pattern. See, that's where I waste all my time, looking around at the pattern that I can't comprehend anyway. But if I'll be still, God will tell me just exactly where to take that next stitch. And, you know, if I take that next stitch, even though I'm scared to death, and my brain is assuring me that it's going to be disastrous if I do in my heart what I know is right, that's faith. Faith is a very uncomfortable thing for me. Faith is a scary thing. Faith is me doing that right thing when my brain is just screaming at me not to do it. And then that nice, warm, fuzzy feeling comes along as the reward for faith. Same with gratitude. Gratitude's not a feeling for me. Gratitude's an action. For the first few years I was sober, I'd sit in an AA meeting, and, you know, I'd go to mostly discussion meetings, and it seems like about one out of three, the topic's gratitude. And I'd want to climb under the table, because I knew I wasn't as grateful as I ought to be. I just didn't feel as grateful as I ought to feel. And I thought, well, you know, it says if I'm not grateful, I might get drunk. So I thought every day I might get drunk. Guess what I found out? I found gratitude's an action. If I act like I ought to act, if I was feeling grateful for AA, I am grateful and I won't get drunk that day. It was about that time that Cherry made me go look up attitude in the dictionary. See, all my life I thought attitude was a state of mind, a state of feeling, and they would kept telling me to change my attitude. Well, I can't change my attitude, and I'd really try. You know, I'd try to change my attitude, and I couldn't change my feelings about things. I looked it up in the dictionary, and the first definition of attitude is from aviation and geometry. It is angle of approach. And folks, my angle of approach to you is the way I act toward you. Regardless of what I'm thinking and what I'm feeling, if I act out kindness, lovingness, and understanding to you, my attitude toward you is kindness, loving, and understanding. Magic in that is that I don't have to do that very long before I start feeling kind, and I start feeling loving, and I start feeling understanding. But if I keep waiting for that mind and that feeling to get there to start acting it out to you, it won't ever get there. But at any rate, I came to believe on that, and Cherry led me through the third step. I went to Cherry and was going to impress him with my newfound spiritual erudition. I thought I was going to be kind of like Jesus astounding the elders when he was 12 or something, and I was talking about my third step, which I thought would be like a Cecil B. DeMille movie where we turned my life and will over to the care of God, and I sort of had it that it thought it would be God and me going in this big room and the entire tapestry of my life being unrolled, and God and I'd walk up and down it, and I really thought I'd point out a few things, and God say, gee, Don, I never thought about that. Yeah, we'll do it that way. That's good. So I started trying to explain that to Cherry, and Cherry said, wait a minute, Don, said, for goodness sakes, don't quote it to me. I know you can do that, but paraphrase it. Tell me what the third step is. And I said, well, it's turning my will and life over to God. And he said, no, it's not turning anything over to God. It's just making a decision to do it. And I said, oh, come on, Cherry, you're splitting hairs. What difference does that make? And Cherry said, Don, this is always so terribly difficult, but I'm going to try to get up on your intellectual level. It says, suppose there are three frogs sitting on a log and one decides to jump in the pond. How many are left? And I said, two. And he said, no, you dumbass, three. He just decided. He hadn't gone anywhere. So he went on to tell me that that's all that is, that the third step said, if you hear a person wondering whether they've done the third step of Alcoholics Anonymous, don't worry about it because they hadn't. Because none of the steps are described any more specifically than the third step is described on pages 62 and 63. And he said, today we always have an understanding person available. Said, so if you hadn't gone in a room with an understanding person and probably gotten on your knees and said words very similar to those on page 63 and intended for that to be the watershed moment in your life when you tried to stop doing it your way and tried to start doing it God's way, you hadn't done the third step of Alcoholics Anonymous. Said, the third step of Alcoholics Anonymous is not kind of some kind of vague thing that evolves. It's a specific set of actions that you've either taken or you haven't taken. So I said, okay, Cherry, you won the semantics war, but see, I still knew where the complexity was. It was absolutely insulting that my third step could be that simple. I said, after I've made this decision to do that, how do I implement it? Because that's what had to be terribly complex. He said, Don, all you're deciding to do is the rest of the steps and the next right thing instead of what you want to do when those things conflict. And he said, if you'll do that just a moment at a time, take that next stitch in the right place, and quit worrying about the pattern, said, that's playing God. Said, in this book where it says we had to quit playing God, said, what that means is we're going to quit trying to figure out the pattern. We're going to stick to stitching, which is all we can do. Said, if you'll do that, you won't have to worry about what God wants your life and will to be, because God will make your life and will what God wants it to be. Cherry led me on through the fourth step and the fifth step in Nashville, and I like starved to death in Nashville sober. I worked on through 6 and 7, 8 and 9. I was never able to get a job in Nashville. I lived there 21 months sober, and when I celebrated a year sober, by that time I had moved out from the folks I was living with, and I was living in an attic with no phone, no car, teeth rotting and out of my head. A woman that I'd been dating most of the first year I'd been sober was out with somebody else, and I was happier than I'd ever been in my life. At about a year and a half sober, as a pure byproduct of doing steps 8 and 9, my law license got put back in order. It wasn't my objective to get my law license. If I had acted like it was my objective to get my law license, instead of acting like it was my objective to do steps 8 and 9, I'd have never gotten a law license, and I probably would have died of alcoholism many years ago. But my law license got put back in order, and because I couldn't find a minimum wage job in Nashville in January of 1980, 83, I went back to Louisville absolutely terrified. And I went up there, and I didn't think AA there would work as well as it did in Nashville, but I threw myself into it anyway, and guess what? It worked just fine. And the second month I was back in town, by God incidents, I talked at the Kentucky State Convention. I was 22 months sober, talking to 2,000 people, and people started saying nice things to me. They started saying, gee, Don, will you be my sponsor? Will you talk here? Will you talk there? That same month, February of 83, I saw my daughter for the first time in over 3 years. And 2 months later, she moved in with me. And she lived with me all through high school. And she and I are dear friends. And she's got 15 years in Al-Anon now. And she and I have given joint Al-Anon AA lead. She's an artist in Park City, Utah. We talk a couple of times a week. And we also can get on one another's nerves bad enough to give the other one the hives in 25 seconds. So I don't want to give you this ideal picture here, but it's sure a lot better than I thought it was going to be ever be. Started making some money right away, and first thing you know, I'm wearing nice clothes and I'm driving new cars, and all these wonderful things are happening. And For the first 9 years that I was sober, and please believe me, I'm not knocking those first 9 years. All those miracles that I've talked about happened. God jerked me up from the jaws of death, and all those wonderful things happened. But the first 9 years that I was sober, relationships with the opposite sex and financial chaos like to have killed me. They like to have beat me to death. And the first 9 years I was sober, I worked so hard on relationships with the opposite sex and financial chaos. And Lord, the tools I was using were prayer, steps, rigorous honesty, meetings, sponsors, outside counseling. And for 9 years, every week, relationships with the opposite sex and financial chaos got worse. And I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know what was wrong, and I was ready to die. I was at my wit's end, and Cherry Carpenter had died. And in May of 1990, a guy who tells me I always use his last name, some many of you have probably heard him, Tom Burns from Avon Lake, Ohio. Tom agreed to be a sponsor, and I flew up to Cleveland. Avon Lake's a suburb of Cleveland in May of 1990, and there was an AA golf tournament, Cleveland Akron there that weekend, and Tom had been sober, I think, 29 years at the time, and these old boys treated him like a newcomer. There was one guy there that had drank with Dr. Bob. And the first thing they told me, we weren't out of the airport. Now, remember, I'm 9 years sober. I've been talking at conferences all over the country for a long time. I'm sponsoring 30 or 40 people. I've listened to over 50 fifth steps. We're walking out of the airport. One of these old guys says, "Ah, sober about 9 or 10 years," says, "that's about the time most folks begin to look at steps 6 and 7. Well, he don't know who he's talking to, but to you. By the time I left there that weekend, I understand, folks, I had it all backwards. I'm not talking about a little off. I had it all backwards. I had done my fourth and fifth step, and I had formed a picture of what a spiritual don ought to be. And for the first 9 years of my sobriety, I thought that was not only okay for me to have that picture, I thought it was my responsibility to carry that picture around. And with God's help, I did know that go to work on me to make me into what I had decided a spiritual don ought to be. So I would grab those character defects by the collar, and I'd slam them up against the wall, and I'd say, "Come here, God, give me a little help, and we'll get rid of this sucker." And God never did come, and I didn't know what was wrong. Turned out that that seventh step prayer that I could have quoted backwards, I didn't realize what it really said. See, I thought it asked for God to remove all my defects of character, or maybe it asked God to remove those defects of character that I had decided were inconsistent with what I thought a spiritual don ought to be. And it doesn't ask for anything like that. It asked God to remove every defect of character that stands in the way of my usefulness to God and my fellows. So it slowly began to become clear to me that those years that I was praying for a character defect to be gone because I wanted it gone, because it was embarrassing me, because it was making me uncomfortable, I might as well have been praying for a bright red Ferrari. I was praying for my own selfish ends, and it was never going to work. And they also pointed out to me that the big book says it in Bill's story, and the 12 and 12 says it in step 6 and 7. Both of them say, "Of myself I'm nothing, the Father does the work." And I knew those things were there, but my brain edited them. My brain edited them to read, "Of myself, I'm not enough, and I have to have some help from God." And folks, that's not what they say. They say, "Of myself, I'm nothing. The Father does the work." So it turned out that 6 and 7 weren't where I went to work on my character defects. 6 and 7 were where I stopped working on my character defects. And 6 and 7 weren't where I went to work to try to make me into what I ought to be. 6 and 7 were where I tried to let go of my picture of what I ought to do, ought to be, and really went back to my third step and just trying to take that stitch to the next place and let God take care of the patterns. Well, I went back to Louisville and started stumbling in that right direction. And I do want to tell you this real quickly, that the entire spiritual journey that I've been on for the last 18 years, the best I've ever been able to do is take a couple of steps in the right direction, get overcome by self-will, knock down, get up, remember the way I'm supposed to be doing it, stumble another couple of steps in the right direction, get knocked down by self-will, get up and start over. And I, to this day, do that on many days 100 times a day. And for the first few years that I was sober, I thought every one of those things was an interruption of my spiritual growth. Because I had it in my head that spiritual growth ought to be just a beam going right straight up. Folks, I know now that that falling and getting down and stumbling in the right direction and falling and getting up is the only spiritual growth that I will ever experience on this earth. It is my spiritual growth. And that's the best I've been able to do any of it. And let me tell you how that's worked real quickly. If in May of 1990, when I was 9 years sober, if God had said, I'm tired of majors whining, and I want him to make a list of everything he wants, and I'm going to grant everything on that list. Please believe me, this sounds like something a person would make up, but it's not. And I had put down what I wanted in my relationship with opposite sex, what I wanted in my financial life, what I wanted in my life in AA, in my law practice, in my relationship with my friends, in the house I live in the cars I drive, the clothes I wear. If I had put that all down at 9 years sober and God had said, here, St. Pete, give it to him, I'm tired of all that mouth, I would have shortchanged myself, sadly, in every single area of my life. My loving God, when I'm willing to let go of those ideas of what I think I ought to be and what I think I ought to have, and just try real hard to do that next right thing, has got things in mind for me that are more beautiful than I'm even capable of imagining. I've always gone to 4 or 5 meetings a week sober. I try to do what I'm asked to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to close with this. You know, I said I started getting on those knees morning and night in April of 81. To my knowledge, I have not missed a morning or night since April of 1981. And I'm not telling you that to tell you how good I am. I'm telling you that for what I believe is a much more important reason. In all those thousands of mornings and nights, a good half the time, it has been clear that I didn't need to get down there. At least half the time, I clearly, no doubt, have not had time to get down there. A big percentage of the time, I have been so scared and or obsessed about something that I could not remember the last word I was trying to pray. A big percentage of the time, it's been absolutely clear that the words were not getting any further than the walls and the ceiling, and it could not possibly be doing any good. But folks, I've gotten down there every morning and every night, and something has worked every single day. And that's the second most important thing in my sobriety. The most important thing in my sobriety is real, real simple. And that is that today, just for today, with God's help and yours, I'm not going to drink or take dope even if my butt falls off. Because, you see, if I do that, it's all gone. That law practice that I've got where they've asked me, a guy that was carried out of the courthouse on a stretcher, a guy was disbarred, totally in disgrace. I'm on a committee in Louisville that passes on the qualifications, the fitness of people to be judges. All that's gone. All that's gone. My loving daughter, that I've been sober over half her life now, all that's gone. If I bend that elbow and I throw that head back and pour it down, and folks, I can. Lord knows I know I can. I'm just as close to a drink as if you hadn't been sober 24 hours. I'm just as close to a drink as you are. And I'm so grateful that my God has let me know that this deal isn't about me being beyond drinking and into some sort of spiritual growth. For me, it's about drinking. Because if I do that, it's all over. And I had to learn the hard way. See, during that 2.5 years that I couldn't get sober, and I was around this program so closely, I thought for it to work that you guys or this God you were talking about were going to somehow knock a drink out of my hand. And I had to learn that that's not going to happen. That's not your job. That's not God's job. Me not drinking or taking dope today with your help and certainly with God's help is my job. So that's the most important thing. I love all of you and thank you for having me.